House Events Affairs Division will come to order. We'll begin with the pledge. Representative Poston, would you lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, welcome everybody, and also those in the audience, to the Veterans Affairs Division Committee. And do we have a motion to approve the minutes for February 20th?
So
moved. And all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. First of all, you see at the end of the table here, we have some treats down there, and they're open not just for the committee members, but if you are a veteran, those cookies are for you too. Thanks to Representative Poston, he's got his first bill in this committee, so what we do here, when you present your first bill, you bring us some treats, so people are the... If you're a veteran, whether you're on the committee or not, you can. Jerry Kaiser, you can have three if you want. And I see Mr. Kurt up there. He's just licking his chops already for some of those cookies. So, but okay. We're going to be out of order here in terms of all the. Which bills we're going to be going through first. We're going to be looking at file 1597. Representative Howell, please come to the table and with your testifiers. And Representative Howell, I'll move House File 1597 before the committee so that it be referred to the State Government and Finance Committee. So, Representative Howell, please tell us about your bill.
Well, I'm hoping that I've got the right one. So I believe that this is the burial fees prohibited?
1597.
Well,
that is.
Mine says.
If it wasn't, you would have had 25 push-ups.
I'll do 40, but that's okay. What this bill does is we've had in the state cemetery, veteran cemeteries, they charge $750 to bury a qualified dependent or a spouse. And it's kind of a little bit of a rub because when they find this out, you can go get buried at, if you qualify to get buried at the
federal
facility at Fort Snelling, it doesn't cost you anything. So what we do here is eliminate that fee, and basically for those folks eligible to be buried there, it eliminates the fee. And my testifier, Ralph, if you want to come down.
Good afternoon. Will you introduce yourself for the record?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ralph Donay. I'm chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council of Minnesota. When I first became aware of the $750 was the day that we interned my mother-in-law. Her husband was in World War II, and both of them had pre-registered at Little Falls to be buried there. And Michelle, the clerk there at the cemetery, looked up at me and said, "Ralph, who's paying the $750?" And I thought she was kidding me. I thought it was a joke, because I had never heard of this. Since then, I've tried to find out, you know, where did it come from, who had it, and I realized it's supposedly money that is used to pay for somebody to plow the snow and mow the grass and replace worn-out equipment. How can you run a facility such as that on a maybe you'll have the money, maybe you won't have the money budget? That, to me, is what this $750 does. If they don't bury enough people this year, does that mean you can't buy a new snowplow or a new lawn tractor or whatever the needs are for the cemetery? How does the person managing that on a maybe income? I just didn't feel that was correct. And since then, I've talked to a few people at a nursing home because I'm involved with a gentleman that has next to nothing. And the nursing home took all of his money and everything he had away, and all he gets to keep out of his Social Security check is $93 a month. Now, how does that person pay for the intern of his wife at a state cemetery? That $93, that's all he gets to keep. So I would ask that this be monies given to the cemeteries to operate so that they don't have to work on a shoestring budget, so they know, so they can plan. Next year we can get this piece of equipment. The year after we can do that. And so to me it would work out much, much better for the facilities. Last year I was told they had about 150 dependents buried at the state cemetery. And Little Falls said they've had between 150 and 200 for the past several years. And I think that we can afford to take that out of the state budget and just pay that right up front. Thank you.
President Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an amendment, but I'm not going to offer it in this committee. It will be offered in State Government Finance to basically appropriate that money to the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to pay that cost. So because this committee doesn't cover that, I was hoping that somebody from Veterans Affairs would testify and tell me exactly how much that cost is. We will see if that happens or not, but is my amendment has a blank in it right now for that amount of money. So if they can tell me money is going to be,
see a smile over there.
We'll be set up for the next committee.
Okay. Would the department like to have a word on this? As always, you're always welcome in this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Brad Lindsay. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Programs and Services for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. So I have some prepared testimony that I'd like to go through, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify regarding House File 1597. I'm going to throw my glasses on here. I made it too small. Sorry. First, let me say that I have no issue with the intent of the bill. Completely respect what Mr. Denise was saying and the feelings involved there. But I do have concerns about the unintended consequences to our current and future cemetery development. So Minnesota Statute 197.236 was enacted in the 1994 session law. The law appropriated $250,000 from the general fund for fiscal year 95 to MDVA's cemetery development and maintenance account to be utilized for development, operation, and maintenance of the State Veterans Cemetery. This section has remained fairly intact except for being amended in 2008 session law. That amendment authorized additional cemeteries, and the commissioner was required to now apply for a plot or interment allowance from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Veterans Benefits Administration, the VBA. It should be noted that prior to the development of the Minnesota State Veterans Cemetery at Preston in southeast Minnesota, MDVA had not been fully funded for staffing or operations at Little Falls. The cemetery development maintenance account has traditionally been utilized to cover general fund shortfalls as well as fund the planning and development of new cemeteries. The Minnesota State Veterans Cemeteries are currently funded through the general fund for what basically equates to maintenance of basic staffing. The funding pays for 7.5 FTEs at each facility. Additional operating costs currently totaling over $300,000, like utilities, IT, seasonal staff, facility maintenance, and equipment are all funded through the cemetery and maintenance development account, which is composed of the VBA burial reimbursements and the spouse-dependent burial fees. For FY16, the revenues from the two operational cemeteries were $310,000 in VBA reimbursements and $117,000 in spouse-dependent burial fees. Our cemetery operations are equipment intensive, which we believe reduces staffing requirements and reduces workers' compensation injuries and associated costs. We have pieces of equipment at each cemetery that cost over $100,000 each. If one of those items needs replacing, we can currently do so without additional funding requests of the legislature and without disruption of our services. The loss of spousal dependent burial fees, which currently amounts to one quarter of our revenues, would surely result in additional funding requests from the general fund. It should be noted that the loss of $117,000 currently does not represent the overall long-term loss. Based on current receipts, the loss of the spouse dependent burial fees would actually be nearly $500,000 per year once all four of our authorized cemeteries are up and fully operational. New cemeteries traditionally, of course, experience a ramping up in burial services. MDVA is legislatively authorized to establish additional cemeteries in the northeast and southwest regions of the state. Last fall, MDVA received a federal grant of $8.35 million for construction of the Northeast Cemetery, which is located near Duluth. The VA uses a cookie-cutter approach to cemetery design, which does not always work for MDVA's operational needs and Minnesota's climate. Because of this, MDVA has obligated approximately $319,000 in additional cemetery maintenance and development funds to ensure this new facility is up to the standards that Minnesota veterans and their families have come to expect from the state. The cemetery development maintenance account deposits are vital to the development of these additional cemeteries. Anyone that's ever built or remodeled their home can attest to the fact that in construction projects, there will certainly be unexpected costs. Those costs are not factored into the amount of the federal construction grant. As an example, in Preston, we had a high level of iron content in our well water, which had to be mitigated at a cost of $325,000. In Duluth, we had to mitigate wetlands before we could even begin construction at the cost of $110,000. So those are but a few of the examples of what we use that cemetery maintenance and development account funds for. In TAP, the maintenance and development accounts composed of federal veteran burial reimbursements and the spouse dependent fees allow MDVA the flexibility to respond to the operational needs of our facilities and meet our legislative mandate to develop state veteran cemeteries in the four corners of Minnesota. Without those funds, MDVA would lose the ability to quickly respond to emerging needs and would be forced to make additional requests for funding from the general fund. So, Mr. Chair, that concludes my prepared testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions from you or the committee if you have any, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lindsay.
Thank you.
And you mentioned there's 7.5 FTEs at each of our two cemeteries.
Yes, sir.
You might not be able to do that now, but could you provide the committee a job description for each one of those FTEs?
Absolutely.
You know, and so we can pass that around to the committee.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure each position a different description in terms of a job?
It is. We basically have an administrator of each cemetery. We have a senior level clerical support specialist, and then we have the rest of the crew are grounds and maintenance crews.
Okay. So. Yeah. We're looking forward to seeing that.
Absolutely.
And are there any questions, other questions from the committee? We got Representative O'Driscoll.
Chair, if you're okay, I'd like to defer my question until after Mr. Johnson, the legislative director, has made his testimony today
okay.
as well.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Johnson. Maybe you didn't have one prepared.
Chair, Representative Driscoll, thank you for the head nod. I didn't have anything in addition. I was on the list in the case that this morning's meetings for the deputy commissioner ran long, so
okay.
I don't have anything to add in addition.
So you're right, it's shotgun.
Sir.
Okay. Any testimony from the audience that would like to in support or not supporting this piece of legislation? Okay. Representative Howell. Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would like to go back to my questions if I could, given the fact that I want the department to have a chance to make their presentation today. Deputy Commissioner Lindsay, did I understand you correctly that there's $117,000 that was collected in spousal interment fees?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, that is correct for last fiscal year, so FY16.
Representative O'Driscoll. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And have any of those fees ever been waived for dependent burials?
Mr. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, yes, they are. When we have a situation where someone is unable to pay or has some kind of financial hardship, the commissioner has the option to waive those fees, and we have done so.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Lindsay. So if the department has the ability to waive those fees, is there a criteria in place, or is it what the individual administrator feels is a hardship case? What's the criteria that's used to make that determination? Commissioner Lindsay?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, there actually is no criteria, right? The individual administrators are empowered with the ability to make that decision.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Deputy Commissioner Lindsay, theoretically, then, the administrator could waive all fees if the administrator felt that everyone who presented themselves for an interment in one of the state cemeteries had a hardship that the individual administrator felt was a hardship. Am I reading that correctly from your testimony? Commissioner Lindsay?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, that is correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Deputy Commissioner Lindsay, if that's the case, would it be in the best interest of the department then to preserve the money that the department feels it needs to have for part of its operation to develop a criteria and then maybe have the legislature agree to that criteria as well? Deputy Commissioner Lindsay?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, rules are always a good thing, administrative rules. So, yes, sir, I believe so. That is one of the things the agency has been working heavily on. We have both of our 90-50 rules on the veterans home side and our 90-55 rules on the veterans programs and services side are currently in revision.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Lindsay, is there a differentiation of fees for an in-ground internment versus an inurnment that might go into one of the columbariums at the Second Cemetery?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, no. No, there's no differentiation. We get the same amount in our reimbursements from the VA for either, and so we charge the same for the spouse-dependent burials as well.
Mr. Chair,
O'Driscoll. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Deputy Commissioner Lindsay, remind the committee again how the $750 is determined as the fee.
Deputy Commissioner Lindsay?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, it's based off the VA reimbursement. It's simplest for us just to make it an equivalent amount.
Mr. Chair, O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this will be my last question. I'm almost certain of it on this topic. Does the cemetery administrator have the ability to modify the scale or just waive fees?
Mr. Lindsay?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, the commissioner has the authority in statute to modify the fees.
Mr. Chair, I think I might have misspoke before. I think I have one other question then.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. So, Commissioner Lindsay, the administrator has the ability to say $750 or zero. They have no latitude between those.
Deputy Commissioner?
That is correct, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Lindsay.
Okay. Thank you. So, Representative Driscoll, what I gather out of those series of questions that we're going to be, you've requested in writing a policy then? Is that what we want out of this?
Oh, Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't know if I was necessarily requesting a policy. I was just trying to get information on how the current program works. And since the department says it is in need of the $750 for spousal internment, but yet there is no criteria in place to determine what a hardship is, but the individual cemetery administrator has the ability to waive that, it seems to me that they're kind of working diametrically opposed to what one goal is versus what Representative Howe is looking to try to do to be able to allow all spouses of qualified dependents to be interned in our state cemeteries. So it's maybe one of those aha moments that something needs to be done, but I'm not specifically requesting anything at this time. My hunch is that after the conversation today, we'll see something in the future from the department on this, because that's something I'm sure the department wants to address.
Okay. Any comments from Commissioner Lindsay on that?
Mr. Chair, just this, like I said, we have been, when the two agencies, the Veterans Home Board and the Department of Veterans Affairs, went back together, there was a severe lapse in the work on rules and policies, and that's something we, the last 3 years now, have dug pretty heavily into. We just, as our HR director was retiring last week, we got a whole set of brand new agency policies which consolidated the old department policies and the home policies into one set. So, and those are just our basics, you know, employee harassment, those sorts of things. So we're moving quickly and working hard on those. So I appreciate the comments.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I don't mean to dominate committee time on this, but this is just very intriguing to me that we've got some what I'll call kind of lapses in administration of this. So someone could go to the National Cemetery, Fort Snelling, and not pay these fees. So in essence, we're competing against a federal cemetery or a national cemetery and a state cemetery for the same burials. And I don't mean to put it in a marketplace competition, but that's probably the easiest way to phrase that. But yet, we're charging the $750, but the administrator can choose to waive. I just, again, think that that brings into question some real gaps in a policy and application.
And I think that's probably why Representative Howell's got this bill before us, and you're going to be going forward to the state government finance. You're going to have an amendment for it, might address this whole funding issue. And we also have Chair Davids has a question.
Yes, thank you. I think Representative O'Driscoll, I don't think it was the cemetery administrator to waive the fees, it's the commissioner, I believe.
For some clarification, Mr. Lindsay,
or Commissioner,
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, the commissioner has the authority, which is delegated to the cemetery administrators.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
If I may, Mr. Chair, just one more clarification on the National Cemetery versus the state. The way the National Cemetery grants work is, much like the veterans' homes. The VA looks at the area and determines the need, and it's usually geographic-based, population-based. So typically we don't compete with Fort Snelling. Those would be generally your Twin Cities veterans go to Fort Snelling, and your outstate veterans are going to our outstate mm-hmm. veterans cemeteries. So.
Yeah, and I know I haven't been able to visit the new cemetery down Preston, but I hear it's quite an addition to our servicemen and women and their families. And Chair Davids, would you like to speak a little bit about
yes,
that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think every member of the committee should be required to come down and visit, and I'll take you out to Branding Iron afterwards.
Okay. I've been up to our Northern Cemetery, and I got really impressed by the staff up there and the facilities, and I think the veteran population is really happy that we've been going forward with our new cemetery and another one up in Duluth area. So, Commissioner, I really appreciate you coming forward. And Representative Howell, do you have any closing remarks?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's in the current statute, it talks about the fees shall cover nearly as practicable the actual cost of interment. I think we've heard here today that they have not done any calculations as to what the actual costs are. So those costs aren't being passed on. They're just copying what they get from the federal government. So I think that's a problem in current statute. And I do believe that if they've delegated this down to the administrator of the cemetery, they could actually shop the cemeteries to see which administrator is going to give them a zero fee. If they don't really care which cemetery they're located in. So I see problems with this. I would much rather see our dependent folks get a free $750. Let's just wipe that out, and let's just make it an appropriation from our state government finance, and just make them whole that way. That way you can depend on how much money you're going to get. I think it's a much better, cleaner way to do business. And that's that's the essence of the bill, and I would look forward to the support from the committee.
Yeah, and I'm sure the state government finance next hearing, maybe I would recommend that the department have a good idea, you know, how many burials we're talking about each year, and then also break down what is the cost for a burial for our veterans, and that might help with the decisions that we make. So, with that, the chair removes the motion. The House File 5097 be referred to the State Government Finance Committee. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 1597 will be referred to State Government Finance. And our next bill is House File 1223. Representative Poston, would you like to just come up with your testifiers to the table? And Representative Howell, make sure you take a cookie before you leave, too. So. Oh, that's right.
Take a couple of them.
And there you go. Take it around the table, and then if we could also maybe have them handed out to the people in the audience too, because if there's any left, yeah. Take two if you want. So, we're up in posting. Would you like to move House File 1223 before the committee and that it be re-referred to Government Operations Committee?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
Okay, here we go. Reverend Poston, your bill is now before us. Tell us about your bill, and and also you'll be introducing your testifiers to it.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1223, First of all, there's a lot of cleanup in the language on this bill, and I'm going to let my testifiers talk to those things. But there are a couple of pieces in the bill that we've talked about over the last few weeks. One was the annual pass for our military to be able to get into state parks and trails and so on, and this bill addresses that. It also addresses 100% permanent disabled vets being able to hunt for small game and fish without a license. The DNR is in support of this bill, and I'll introduce my testifiers here to talk to some of the language change. So I have Bob Meyer and Peter Hart, Bob with the DNR and Peter is with the Division of Parks and Trails.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, Assistant Commissioner, and thank you so much for hearing this bill today. It does a couple of things, as the office spoke of it. It clarifies the entrance into parks, and it also picks up a lot of different pieces that standardizes our eligibility for licenses. In your packets, you'll see a brochure that we have that just highlights the department's efforts. We are a Beyond the Yellow Ribbon member, and we take very seriously the work that our veterans have done in making sure that we can do whatever we can as an agency to help them not only participate and be outdoors, but also as an employer, making sure we're providing every opportunity possible. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll have Peter Hart go through the two parks provisions, and then I can go through the hunting and fishing pieces of the bill.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair of the committee, Peter Hart, Operations Manager for DNR Parks and Trails Division. Just real briefly, there's, as was stated already, what we're trying to do on the state parks side of this is really clean the language up and tighten it up so it's administratively more efficient for us and for veterans and active military personnel who are visiting our parks. Currently, the language is confusing to our seasonal staff and trying to decipher who is eligible or not when they're walking through the doors. Sometimes we have 16, 17-year-olds that are working for the summer, so that training aspect is pretty intense. Also, the language is just somewhat confusing. So in the first part, what we're trying to do is allow active military personnel who already has a national lands or national parks and lands pass. Our language would conform with that language. And so if someone showed up in the doors with that pass, an active military individual, we would allow them in. And so that it cleans that up. And it also adds their dependents, family and dependents, into that. So if someone is on call of duty, active service, their spouse or family members would also have that same ability to walk, visit our parks at no cost. They're also issued an ID through Department of Defense, the CAC card. The second section is really about veterans with disabilities, and right now, if you are a Minnesota resident veteran with a partial service-related disability, you are eligible for a day pass. If you are a resident of any state and 100% disabled veteran, you're eligible for an annual pass. And so what we're saying is that we just want to open up to any level of service-connected disability. They'd be eligible for an annual pass. What happens is that we have veterans that come in day after day. They have to fill out the same form. It is ridiculous. And so this just kind of opens it up and cleans it up and allows administratively get rid of paperwork and be a little bit more sensitive to our folks who are served and have that service-connected disability. So those are some of the highlights around this. Right now, just real quickly, the passes that we give out for military-related veterans or active service military is about 1.5% of the total annual and daily passes that we sell. So it's a pretty small number. I'll just leave it like that. So, Mr. Chair, committee, if there's any questions, I can certainly try to answer those.
So if a veteran with a disability, any rating from 10 to 100%, what do they first need to present to you, to the DNR, to
right now the way the current language is written is that they need to present a U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs determination letter.
Okay.
So they come in with actual pieces of paper and do this. And we'd still require that, but the language that we wrote in would allow the DNR to also allow the use of the License Bureau issue of 100% disability pass. There's also a VA health card that would be eligible. There's some other forms of ID that we think people come with anyway, and we have to turn them away because it's not the termination letter from the VA. And it's
Mr. Hart, would this have to be done on a yearly basis then, just once a year, or once this is done, it's done? Or
Mr. Chair, it is an annual pass, the day they issue that pass, it's stamped for that month,
okay.
And that's good for 1 year, 12 months.
Okay. Are any questions from the committee? Are there any questions from any other testifiers out in the audience? I see we have one. Mr. Diamond? Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair. Tom Diamond, DFO Veterans Conference. I certainly speak in support of this, but I just suggest a minor change that was done in the Senate committee on this. And what that change is, if you look under on page 2, line 10, the entrance permit, Commissioner shall issue, and then on line 11, and cross out and after permit, make that add an S, so it's an S. The reason for the suggested change is this is kind of how things are done now. But using myself as an example, if I have a pickup truck and a car, if I get the permit, I have to fasten it to the windshield of the vehicle. You can't move it from vehicle to vehicle. So if I put it in the one, if I come another, what they do is they take a day pass. But what they want to do is clean this up so you do an annual pass. So what this would do would allow that they could issue you two passes, one to put in each vehicle, and just using this example. It still only applies if you go down to 18, it only applies to the permit of a decal issued to the owner of the vehicle with that person in the vehicle. So it's not like these would be used for anybody else. And so it's a procedural issue that mimics how it's done now, but just would work with the new provision where it's just annual passes that would be issued.
Any questions on that comment? Yes. Representative?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question I have is, this is the same situation that anybody buying a yearly pass would be in, though, wouldn't it? That if you buy a yearly pass and you're given a permit, you have to decide what vehicle you're putting it in?
Mr. Diamond?
Yes, that's correct. And what I say is that the way this is currently administered when they do issue passes for the veterans is that they issue an annual pass. But then if you come in a different vehicle, they will issue you a daily pass. And what the idea with this is to go to all annual, using annual passes. So how you would get around that is you would be able to provide for those who have more than one vehicle that they use, it would allow them to have one put into the windshield of either one.
Would the department like to make some comments here?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hart.
I think if I understood it right, what was being described is that a couple passes would be issued on the spot. Is that what
you could get it?
Yeah. Currently, how we do it, if you drive into park, buy a state park pass, that's issued to that vehicle that you're in at while they're driving through the gates. So anyone has the option to buy a second pass at a reduced cost if they have a second or third vehicle. I think it would work. I think to keep it simple for staff, for someone driving through the gates and be able to issue them a couple stickers, it's hard to manage that and across our system. But we could work with that. But I think that veteran or active service individual drove through and they had a different car, they just show their CAC card or their whatever ID and we would issue them right on the spot, so it wouldn't be that big of a deal.
Okay. Mr. Polston or Mr. Diamond,
just follow up. That I think works fine. Is you could just, when you come in, if it's another vehicle, you can get the pass at that time. You don't have to issue two or three times.
Well, I see some concerns sometimes that, everybody else goes through and they get a sticker. They take the back off for you, and you have to stick it right on your vehicle that you have there. Everybody's gone through that. And I don't think veterans want to be, treated any differently in that aspect. I'm speaking of myself as a veteran, too. We can work things out with the author of the bill and the department can work some things out. So,
thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. With that, Reverend Poston, any other closing remarks, or if the department has anything?
Bob would like to make a few comments.
Okay.
Commissioner? Members, thank you so much for indulging us and listening to the concerns we have on the bill here. Just one real quick reason why we need to go to government operations is, because I was hoping the chairman of that committee would have been here still, is just to deal with that question you brought up on how do we identify what the paperwork or what the person presents. You'll see the language here on 1.20 to 1.23. It'll allow the commissioner to establish what constitutes a qualifying military identification by written order published in the state register, and then that this order is exempt from rulemaking provisions under Chapter 14. This is boilerplate language that we often put in bills that we're looking to make a decision. Whenever the commissioner needs to make a decision, we're very intentional about if these are going to be a commissioner's order published in the state register or seek rulemaking authority so people can know how that decision has been made very publicly and openly, and we'll work with the other agencies to make sure we're using the correct information and the correct documentation to do that.
Okay.
With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Chair Davids.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to point something out just logistically here. I believe one of the previous witnesses referred to a decision made in the Senate. I believe, according to Mason's 2.45, that is not allowed, so just please take note of that.
Yeah, that's right.
We wouldn't want poor decisions made here.
Here, here.
You can't mention the other body, the other house. Okay. Okay. Dr. Poston, close remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is good for veterans. I think this simplifies things for the DNR, and I would just ask for your approval.
Okay, with that, Representative Poston renews his motion that House File 1223 be re-referred to Government Operations. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 1223 is referred to Government Operations. And Representative Poston, you might as well stay in the hot seat. You have another bill coming up.
Yes.
Next bill is on the agenda. It is House File 1318. And could I get a raise of hands of how many thought those cookies were good? Yeah, there we go. There. Look at that. Look at that. So thank you again for the treats. Representative Poston, would you like to move your bill before the committee and that it be referred to the State Government Finance Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Poston, your bill is before us. So I understand you also have an author's amendment, the label A1, to get the bill in the form that the author wants. Does everybody have a copy of A1 amendment? I think it was in the wrong folder. It might have been in with 1223.
Mr. Chair, I think he's handing it out right now.
Okay. So it was in, I think, in the A1 amendment was in the folder for the 1223 bill we just heard. And everybody have a copy? Governor Poston, to your amendment.
The amendment just changes some language, as you can see, Mr. Chair. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. It just changes a little bit of language, and it cleans up the bill and puts it in the shape that I'd like it to be in.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye, I mean. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. To your bill.
Mr. Chair and committee, House File 1318 is a bill that creates a hiring preference for disabled veterans and veterans with the Minnesota legislature and with the judicial branch. Currently, there are preferences for veterans and with other jobs in the state of Minnesota, but not with the legislature and not with the judicial branch. So this would add those two branches. The way this works is you have to be qualified for the position. You would get preferential treatment if you're qualified. You'd be interviewed if you're qualified, at least three veterans for a position, if that many applied for the position. You'd be interviewed. If you got the job, great. If you didn't get the job, it would be up to one of these bodies to come back to you and tell you why. So it would be a learning experience if they didn't get the job. It also pertains to a disabled veteran spouse. So if you're disabled and a job opens up with the legislature or the judicial branch and your spouse qualifies for it, they would get the same treatment. And I have a couple of testifiers here from the VA, and I'd like for them to give their testimony at this time. Brad Lindsay and Ben Johnson.
Looks like it's Mr. Johnson's turn.
Welcome
to the committee, Mr. Johnson. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Detmer, members of the committee, my name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And I do have Deputy Commissioner Lindsay here if we need more specific answers. But generally speaking, I'm here to testify on behalf of this inclusion of the legislature and the court system in the veterans preference
MDVA operates veterans' preference when it rises to the level of a complaint to the commissioner as the final arbiter of decisions for that. But we were happy to help with the language, the amendment that was before you, and making sure that it was in the right form for today, and are just here in support of veterans' preference in general and the expansion to the legislature in court.
Okay. Just for committee members, when people come to me and ask me about possible bills for veterans' issues, first thing I'll usually say, well, have you discussed it with the department? And sometimes that's what you need to do first, is go to the department and see what the current status reads and how we can make things better. So I think Representative Polston, I think you've took that route. Any questions from the committee? Any testimony from the audience? We're going fast. I think everybody's looking at those cookies. Okay, right here.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Polston, on behalf of another freshman colleague, congratulations on your first bills in this committee. I ask a lot of my colleagues to talk about the equity impact for their bills, and I want to ask you because when we talk about veterans and we talk about folks with disabilities in general, and when we talk about disabled veterans, that is disparate outcomes for both of those categories, and so this will have a positive impact on disparities that we already have here in Minnesota. And so I wanted to commend you for that, and I wanted to lift that up as a really great piece of this bill. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, any other questions or testimony?
Okay. Representative Polston, any closing remarks?
Mr. Chair, I'd just say that, again, this is, I think, a good bill for our veterans, and I would very much appreciate your support.
Okay. With that, Representative Polston renews his motion that House File 1318, as amended, be referred to State Government Finance. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd also really appreciate it if you'd all eat some more cookies.
Okay.
And then take a few with you when you leave.
There you go. That's an order, by the way. That's an order. 1318 is amended. Is we refer to State Government Finance.
Mr. Johnson, take some back to the Commissioner Shelato.
So. He's in D.C. I don't think they'll last until he's
gone. Oh, well, you can still take some back, though. I know they won't last. Next, we have two bills on the agenda. They're identical, by the way. And House File 1438 and House File 1526. Representative Bliss, you're here at the table. And since the language of both the bills are identical, we will hear both bills at the same time. Representative Bliss, would you like to move your House File 1438-1526 before the committee, and that they will be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move.
Okay, the bill is before us. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. The first bill is the Veterans Journey Home. That's a nonprofit agency that provides affordable housing to disabled veterans, and I have a couple of testifiers here that would like to fill you in a little bit more on the details.
Okay. Please introduce yourself, Trista.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Trista Mattis-Castillo. Thank you, committee members, and General Frost, who's in the audience as well. I am a veteran who am now the development director of Veterans Journey Home, which is a nonprofit that provides affordable housing for veterans. It is a very similar model that you might be familiar with other nonprofit agencies like Habitat for Humanity that builds affordable housing. We specifically work with veterans and their families that meet the area median income from 40 to 80% AMI. And so we're working at an affordability rate. The difference in our model is that oftentimes when there are affordable housing agencies, they don't truly understand military and veteran culture, or they have requirements that actually eliminate veterans from accessing that housing option. For instance, a credit record A lot of veterans have poor or bad credit from deployments, from divorces, marriage. Those things add up, and it takes them out of that housing pool. That same impact happens on first-time home buyers. A lot of programs are for first-time home buyers, and then, again, it takes them out of that pool. And so we have this group of veterans that are still in need of affordable housing but can't get it. As you know, across the state of Minnesota, our housing has finally recovered, and also that access to affordable housing is getting farther and farther away, especially if with veterans and their families perhaps living on a fixed income or their income being from disability or caregiver stipends. And so we work with veterans in that category. We also take an account, oftentimes some veterans have had intersection with the criminal justice system, and that would take them out of running for other affordable housing agencies, and our agency does that case by case, so that we're actually helping to stabilize a family, stabilize a veteran, and get them back on track. We work both in home ownership, so we will sell our houses to veterans, or we will rent to them until which time that they're able to buy the houses. And we're setting that up on an affordability scale. Our houses are either new construction or rehab to new, and we're also making them accessible for disabilities. And we're building all of our houses with accessibility, even if the veteran may not require it at this time. We know that as we age from our service-connected disabilities, oftentimes that becomes a factor. And so our goal really is to build houses statewide for veterans that meet this need. I have one of our veteran home occupants with me to testify on the impact of veteran housing, and his name is Dan Hansen.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Daniel Hansen. Whew, I don't know if I've had too many cookies or I'm nervous. So,
sugar high.
So. Yeah. Thank you for the time. I'll just give you a little bit of my story, then how I ended up getting a house with Vets Journey Home. But one of three brothers in the Marine Corps, older brother in the Navy. You know, everybody's got a black sheep of the family. So shortly after I joined the Marine Corps, I was deployed to Ramadi, Iraq, in an intense deployment where we lost 34 men, had several hundred injured, and came back, went on another deployment shortly after getting out of the Marine Corps. My younger brother, who was a Marine, was struggling and ended up taking his life. And after that time, I went down a pretty dark road, made a lot of poor decisions, it affected my life deeply. And after getting my life back on track, housing was an issue for me. I have four wonderful children, and I was in and out of different rental properties trying to get myself into a home that was adequate for my children. And the last home that I ended up in was my mom's house, as good as her pancakes are. After 18 months, I was really ready to get out of there, and I was approached by Mrs. Matt Castillo and Veterans Journey Home, and it really changed my life. It got me to a place of stability that I hadn't had in a long time. I was still working full-time, and I was still, what I believe, doing a lot of good in the community, just wasn't able to get into a good home. And Veterans Journey Home was able to provide that stability for myself, for my children. For them to have that was a real life changer for me and for my children once again. And I've been there since last year, and I can't tell you how important it's been to have that need filled in my life and in my children's life. And can't thank Veterans Journey Home enough for that. So thank you for your time, and if there's any questions, I'd love to answer them.
I have a question. Madam Castillo, do you, I always goof that, you know me, I have a problem with your last name for some reason, but anyway, I even practice it before you come here. But now the veterans have skin in the game here.
Yeah.
They have a mortgage that they pay. Could you just talk a little bit about that? It's not a free mortgage or anything, so they're working.
Okay. Yes, Chair Demmer, our model is set up so that they're actually paying for this house. They have skin in the game. There are several groups out there building houses for veterans that are in mortgage-free homes. There are very few of those. There are some, but the success rate of with those veterans as longtime homeowners is actually really low. We know that when people put skin in the game, that it becomes theirs. And so we are honoring the dignity. The veterans are actually purchasing the home. There's in your packet kind of explanation, but we sell it to them a third of their income or less, right, because that's the definition of affordable housing. And then we're putting a silent second mortgage on that so that our investors, our funders, know that they're not just going to turn it around and sell it and make a big profit. Most of our houses on average are appraising at about $300,000, and we're selling them for about $150,000, with the difference being in that silent second mortgage. That goes away over time. Essentially, when the house is paid for, that mortgage also goes away, that silent second. But that really helps us stabilize the longevity. The other unique thing about our houses, the way that we're able to sell them at such a low price, is that our investment is relatively low of the exact financial investment. So this appropriation, putting in $50,000 in cash, gets us the land, the property, but we're partnering with local colleges that are actually building the houses. So all of them here in the Twin Cities have been built by St. Paul College. So the classroom has moved to the job site. So we provide the materials, they build the houses. In the past, that college was building birdhouses. Their construction class is building birdhouses. And so we've flipped that. And so now they're actually building houses on site. We have three in Badness Heights that they're working on now. They just finished three in Shoreview. And we're moving across the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Any other questions? Any other questions from the in the audience? Any comments? Yes. Representative Beckerthin.
Thank you. I just wanted to acknowledge that several of these homes have been built in my district. So I'm familiar with what goes on in Ramsey County. I was just curious if there is any movement. I mean, not that we don't want houses in our district, but if there are houses built throughout the Twin Cities, or if we are looking at rural Minnesota as
this
well.
This is Mattis Castillo.
Yes. Chairman, Representative, so we currently have 40 houses, actually. So we hit Anoka County, Ramsey County. We just partnered with the city of Isanti and the city of Duluth that are providing us lots. So we'll be building there. We actually have a veteran family that we are working with that is building in Grand Marais, Mankato, Rochester. So we have 15 other houses that are built, and most of them are in rural Minnesota. We are going where the veterans are and where the veterans have a need, and we're building it to match that family's need within the community.
Representative Beckerthin.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me more about how this grant from the state would be used? Is it
Yes.
Ms. Mattis Castillo.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative, we are the money exactly would go into the house. So you, generally speaking, about $50,000 in cash will leverage us enough to raise the additional funds or partners. So it would go into construction materials, maybe the purchase of the land itself if it hasn't been donated to us, which oftentimes cities or counties are donating land. So it would go directly into the building of the house or the material purchase of the materials so that we can partner with the local college.
Reverend Pryor.
And just how many houses can, how far would the $700,000 go? Any projection on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, roughly I would say it could go to 20 to 30 houses depending on, you know, how well we do with the money. But, so 20 or 30 houses, which are families. Typically families are four or more. Currently in our 40 houses, we are housing over 225 people. So.
Okay. Dr. Pryor? Okay. Any other questions? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just have a question. How are our veterans selected? And you mentioned that some of the houses in Mankato, Rochester, you try to meet their needs. So do we select the families first and then build a house to meet their needs, or how?
Yeah.
Mattis Castillo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a great question. We're doing a little bit of both. So we have a few houses that We have, because the city came to us and had a timeline, that we initiated and started those houses. For instance, the three in Badness Heights that are currently being built and will be soon done. We don't already have families partnered with those houses, but we're working diligently. We have dedicated and partnered with the city there in Badness Heights that for sure one of them will go to a Hmong veteran, and so we're working with the council to identify a veteran, so we're doing that through the community as well. In other places, so I have both a waiting list of veterans' families who have already come to me and said, I meet the requirements, I'm a great partner family, and we need to build houses, so I have that pool. And then in some places, it's not exact match, so it's a little bit of both. And we're relying on community and or referral agents to help us get those veterans. So, for instance, there's a house in Shoreview just a couple hundred feet down from Dan's house that we house two women veterans and their families that came out of a referral from Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. So it's a duplex, and we were able to house them right away.
Governor Lee?
Mr. Chair, so could you tell us how many families are on the waiting list right now so that we can get an idea?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I currently have 17 families on the waiting list across the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Well, thank you. And Representative Bliss, any closing remarks?
Just that it's an honor to present this bill, and I would ask for your support.
Representative Bliss that renews his motion that House File 1438 to be re-referred to State Government Finance. I'm going to have to do both bills, by the way. For 1438, all in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Then also, Representative Bliss renews his motion that House File 1526 be referred to the State Government Finance also. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So, House File 1438 and 1526 are re-referred to State Government Finance. Our next bill on the agenda, Representative Bliss, you're in the hot seat again. Representative Bliss, would you like to move your bill before the committee and that it be re-referred to State Government Finance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would.
So we're at 1527, House File 1527, and your bill is before us, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This bill addresses the Support Our Troop fund that is funded through the purchase of license plates, and there is currently a balance of, I believe, $1.4 million in this account, and the fund was set up to help veterans, and we're not spending it quick enough, so we're proposing expanding the qualifications and the amount of money that is allotted. And Mr. Kerr, he will go into the details of the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Kerr, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. Representative Bliss gave a good summary of the bill. The fund has been in existence for a little over 10 years. It was enacted in 2005, went into effect in 2006. And over that time, we originally weren't sure exactly how much revenue was going to be generated by the sale of the plates or how long that would sustain itself, so we went rather conservatively in our distribution of those funds. But as we have gained some experience in utilizing the fund, we've noticed a couple of things. Number one, we are bringing in more money than we're sending out. And number two, the requirements for need on the part of the individual service members that are applying for these grants, the amount continues to increase, and in many cases, the grant requirement or the grant request exceeds the amount that's capped in statute. That actually hasn't been a problem for our service members because of the good people at the Minnesota Military Family Foundation, who function to administer the grants for us to individuals, have often made up the difference between the state authorized amount and the amount of need using their own funds. And there are two members of the organization here to speak to that. And I guess I'll turn it over first to Major General Trost for their testimony, and then I'll stand for questions as well.
Okay, Mr. Trost, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee, Major General retired John Trost, the Vice President of Minnesota Military Family Foundation. So thank you for hearing these proposed changes for the Support Our Troops money. As part of the Minnesota Military Family Foundation, we are, our mission statement says that we are to provide a financial safety network for currently serving soldiers in Minnesota. That includes the Minnesota Army and Air National Guard, the Army Reserve, the Air Reserve, Marine Corps Reserve, Naval Reserve, and also to active duty soldiers that happen to be residing in Minnesota at this time. So if a need, a financial need, comes to the Minnesota Military Family Foundation, we will then, once it's been vetted through the Family Assistance Centers, we will then provide a grant, not a loan, a grant to that family and pay the vendors of that soldier. No money goes to the soldier or service member. The money goes to the vendors in their time of need. A little bit about the Minnesota Military Family Foundation. Since 2004, we have disbursed approximately $3.3 million in grants and just a little bit over 1,500 grants throughout that time. What we are seeing over time, though, is that the amount that is coming to the foundation in the form of these requests continues to go up a little bit. Since the 1st of January, 16 grant requests have come in. 25% is below 2,000. 44% is in the 2,000 to 3,000. Another 25% is in the 3,000 to 4,000. 6% of the requests that have come in have been over $4,000. So we're asking to a change of statute which would allow the SOT money up to a maximum of $4,000 per grant be changed to read $4,000, and then foundation money would be used to help those take it over that. Those are requests that are over that amount. We're very proud of the Minnesota Military Family Foundation for what it's done since 2004. I might add that we're a totally volunteer organization. We are made up of volunteers. Everything that we do is by volunteer. And we also detail 99% of our money to mission. We have a 1% overhead. We pay an outside agency to audit our books as required by state law annually. And we just feel that we want that done with an outside set of eyes looking at us. So we're very proud of where our money is going and how it is being used. I would yield to my fellow board member here, Mr. Tom Lyons, for further.
Mr. Lyons, the voice.
Mr. Chairman, good to see you again.
Yes.
My name is Tom Lyons, and I've been on the board of directors of the Minnesota Military Family Foundation for over 8 years. And I also run some charity golf tournaments to raise funds so that we have some reserves and never run out of monies to pay these grants. Excuse me. I'm a little averse to microphones, as you know. I'm a volunteer host of Minnesota Military Radio, which has been on the air for 6.5 years and is now heard on 39 radio stations all over Minnesota. And, of course, we're always happy to have you on, Mr. Chairman, to give us some updates what's going on.
Thank you.
As a Vietnam veteran, and also a veteran of the 133rd Airlift Wing way back in the day, 40-some years ago, I'm proud and happy to be a member of the board and to be able to help take care of today's veterans, today's military personnel and their families. When we get these grant requests in from the Family Assistance Centers, which do all of our due diligence for us, they go out and they verify the financial need. They go out and they help find vendors that a lot of times will put in the labor for free, and then they send in a grant request to us with all the information that we need. We usually turn those grant requests around in a matter of an hour or two, and when they're approved, and I think in the last 8 years only three of them haven't been approved, and that was because they needed to do a little financial counseling before we could deal with it. We usually get the grants paid within 24 hours. We pay the vendors. If they're behind on the rent, we pay the landlord. If there's a repairman involved, we pay the repair. So our delivery service via the Family Assistance Centers is as efficient as it can be. And as General Trost indicated, we are a 501c3 charitable entity, and the only bills we pay are for the annual audit required by the IRS and a little bit of postage to send out a letter at the end of the year just confirming any of the donations we get. So we think we perform a real valuable service. We're very happy to have support our troop money available to help us support our troops and our veterans. And we're very focused on delivering this these grants as quickly as we can. And it's a point of honor to us that when we have deployed service members overseas, in today's technology, if there's a problem back home, they find out about it immediately. And the Family Assistance Center is usually there within 24 hours of the phone call, verifies the need, gets the grant request into us, and we usually get it paid for and fixed within a day or two. And if you can imagine being deployed how terrible you feel about not being able to help your family, now think how good you feel that there's people back here in Minnesota taking care of the families and taking care of those problems so that you can focus on the mission and get home safe. So we're here today to see if we can increase the amount. One of the things that General Crost told you about is when we started, that annual limit of about 2,000 worked. But today, because of inflation, because of things always just seem to be more complicated today, and the grant requests that are coming in are more complicated, and the numbers are going up. And so we're working very hard to make sure that we've got some reserves in case for those amounts would not be allowed under the Support Our Troops money. But we would very much appreciate if we could get this changed, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Lyons, and maybe a personal story. During my deployment, I was over in Camp Doha down in Kuwait during the Iraqi Freedom, and we had a new National Guard soldier come into my section that I was in charge of. He's a Spec 4. Spec 4 is making, what, $36,000, $37,000, and his civilian, he owned a company that was, he was making, a construction company, was making over $100,000 in a year, and him and his wife now are trying to decide what they're going to sell off of his company so that he can make things go while he's deployed. So situations like this with this program can help these types of families out. So I'd like to thank you, Representative Bliss, for bringing this forward. I know you have an amendment that you're going to be bringing on in the next committee because it's a finance committee, and I don't know if you wanted to address that now, or you don't have to, but okay.
I can address it quickly. It's basically there was $10 million transferred out of the enlistment money, enlistment bonus money, to maintenance, and we're putting on an amendment to bring $2 million of that back to the enlistment numbers.
Okay.
And that'll be input or added at the next stop.
Okay. Any questions from any other questions from the committee? Any other testimony from the audience? Okay. Representative Bliss renews his motion. House File 1527 be re-referred to the State Government Finance. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 1527 is re-referred to State Government Finance.
Thank you.
And the last item on the agenda is a presentation by, I think, some of the most important people that we have in our counties is our county service officers. We've invited the county service officer to come in, present, do a presentation for the CVSOs of our counties. We have Jason Marcourt, president of the County Veteran Service Officers Association, and of Fillmore County, veteran service officer. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you said, my name is Jason Marquardt. I'm the president of the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. You're both handed out two different packets. One's the short version of my presentation. One's the 78-page version. They told me I didn't have time to give you guys all 78 pages, and I had to highlight it on 8 pages. But I wanted to make sure that you had the basic information that our offices do now. Every one of our offices is different, and we kind of may get into the weeds a little bit deeper on some other things. Like me, I'm looking at retirement out of the United States Army Reserve, so I kind of like to know more of the retirement stuff. Other service officers have different areas of emphasis emphasis that they like to work in and help veterans with. So we all kind of work together. But in the smaller packet, you can see the mission statement. And our sole purpose is to help the veteran. In some of the packet, it says in our county, it doesn't matter what county they live in, we're going to help them no matter what. Some of the information says character of discharge. I've had many cases that I've helped veterans upgrade their character of discharge because of whatever happened with their time in service. So just because it's in black and white for us as service officers doesn't mean it's really black and white. We like to look at the gray area in laws that legislators like to put forward and get the veterans their benefits that they deserve for serving their country. The second page is just the statute that governs our offices and our jobs. It goes from stat 197.06 to 197.608. If you want to look at them, they're good statutes, and they help enhance our offices. So the third slide would be, nationally, there's about 22 million living veterans. Here in Minnesota, there's approximately 361,000. And out of that 361,000, there's 66,000 Minnesota veterans that have served after 9/11. 43,000 of them, and it's hard to see in there because of the helmet.
And Mr. Marquardt, state statute was in last bill's packet. It was in the wrong one, so it's right here. You'll find it. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thanks, sir. You can't see it on the helmet, but 43,000 Minnesota veterans have served in active duty. Now, they could have served in any branch along with the reserves and the National Guard. So we have a high number of veterans. Continuing on, Minnesota has 87 counties. There's a veteran service officer in every single county. Some counties may share their service officer. I know Pope and Stevens is one example where the veteran service officer works in both counties helping veterans. There's two or three counties that are like that. Otherwise, there's at least one veteran service officer in every county. You look at Hennepin County, they have 10. Ramsey County has 3. Marie's sitting up there, so I got to make sure I get the number right. So it just depends on our veterans population. Me in Fillmore County, there's just myself. I take care of 1,500 veterans. So it depends on population. And even you talk numbers, those 1,500 veterans that I personally serve, not all of them are active clients, but something can happen in their lives that they become an active client. So in the state of Minnesota, $2.6 billion is generated in revenue from the Department of Veterans Affairs. And that's billion with a B. My little county of Fillmore, it's $4.8 million that actually comes in revenue for veterans. So we as service officers handle the majority of that first claim for that veteran and additional claims to help ensure that veteran's receiving that benefit. If you go to the next page, there's a lot on that page. That is the highlights of everything that we touch. So you got recently discharged veterans. You know, we help them get their DD-214 to the assessor's office free of charge, because most counties will not allow the veteran to walk into the recorder assessor's office and certify their own. It has to come through us, which ensures that they get contact with us. We get to meet with them. We get to set them up as best we can for their benefits. life insurance is another thing through the Department of Veterans Affairs that we handle. You go to the disability benefits, you got service connection, you got non-service connection pension, you got vocational rehabilitation, which is a 100% school program where the veteran like myself can actually go obtain a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, certificate, technical degree. But the caveat with that is you have to be service connected. So the veteran has to come see a service officer, we get them service connected, they go get a degree. I actually just finished my master's degree in professional development at Winona State under the clinical mental health track with this program because of my service connection level. So getting that veteran that 100% paid for school and them retaining their GI Bill benefits to go back to school if they need to for extra stuff is a great way for them to save benefits. Healthcare, we've all heard about the VA healthcare system. We help the veteran file that paperwork. Most offices will help set up appointments. A lot of counties have county vans that actually go to and from the VAs. So just a few programs that we administered that way. Survivor death benefits. There's many different programs, whether it's the spouse or it's the children. There's some service officers that have even gotten parents survivor's benefits because of their child being killed on active duty. People don't think of that one, but it's out there. Education, there's state education benefits we help with, the federal. I talked about the Volk Rehab is one. The post 9/11 GI Bill, there's still service members using the Montgomery GI Bill. State of Minnesota has a GI Bill that we help get veterans in touch with the correct individuals. The Minnesota State Assistance We help with the Minnesota State Assistance Council for veterans, getting them with MACV in case they're at risk of homelessness. The legal clinics. A lot of counties actually have legal clinics in their own county that MACV will put on for them, and that's all free of charge to the veteran and their families. State Soldier Assistant Program. The Department of Veterans Affairs in Minnesota is really phenomenal about sending the veteran to their CVSO if they want to use that program, because most of that program requires a recommendation from us. So we work very well with MDVA to make sure that the veteran is getting all their benefits. If you look through the big packet, that slide kind of gets broke down a little bit more on everything. So with service connection, you might have direct service connection, aggravated by service, presumptive. There's a lot more stuff in the big packet. So, and then, as I said before, in closing, each service officer and their office is unique. We all do the same function, but we all also may focus on something else. I know one thing I like to do in Fillmore County is have our annual golf tournament at the golf course. It gets veterans together with non-veterans like Representative Davids. He comes out. He's always my golf partner. He shows me up every time. But it's nice to have him, the county commissioners show up, some of the sheriff shows up, and get veterans and non-veterans together so they can see what else is out there within the county. And a lot of counties do a lot of different things. So that's kind of our job in a nutshell. And they said I had 10 minutes, so I don't know if I made it or not.
You're doing just great, Mr. Marquardt. And just a point to everybody else in the committee, you know, we all live in counties. And remember, I mentioned that we should all get out and visit our American Legion posts, VFW posts. Another person you should set up an appointment with is your county service officer, veteran service officer. Just set up an appointment with them, chat with them, get some feedback, you know, and you might come back to the legislature with maybe a good idea for a piece of legislation and that are for men and women that are serving. But many times I get calls from, and I'm sure you get calls from people regarding a veteran's issue, and I always ask them, well, have you contacted your veteran service officer? And many times the answer is no, that they somehow they get a hold of our name. And what I'll do, I'll look up on the directory. I'll ask them what county they're from and so forth, and this is who you need to call. Here's the number. They will answer your questions. So any questions of Mr. Marquardt? Luke, Representative Luke.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Detmer. I just want to echo what Chair Detmer indicated, because I almost weekly am dealing with one or two veterans serve as officers, sometimes two of them. I've got two counties, Crowing and Aiken County, that are within my district. And, yeah, there's a lot of times we get the first email when an issue comes up down here in St. Paul. And if it's a veterans issue, almost always it can be settled right back there with the veteran service officer in the county. So I just want to thank you. It's just an absolute great resource. The other thing that our county veteran service officers work very well with is our federal legislators, because you know, I don't think they know we exist up there in Washington, D.C. If you tell them you're from St. Paul, they hang up on you, don't they? But that relationship with our federal legislators and their staff, so when they call Washington, D.C., they know that, you know, their legislator sits back there in Washington, D.C., so that's just really an important thing, because a lot of things can be solved by our state veteran services folks, but they can also guide things where sometimes it has to be the federal arm of the veterans, particularly in the medical side. I mean, we've had appointments put back in place that fell through, all kinds of things, and that's, you know, really the work that's done right there at the local level. So again, I just can't thank you enough for all the folks out there that do this every day.
Well, thank you. And just to put out there is that because we've been close to target, or excuse me, the first deadline for our bills, there might be a possibility we might have a committee meeting on a Friday, I think Friday the 10th. So just kind of keep that in mind. We don't know for sure yet, but we might have to have one to make sure all of our bills get through their first hearing. And Mr. Poston.
Thank you, Chair Detmer. You mentioned that you had a directory of these county personnel. Could we get a copy of that?
You go right online with the Department of Veterans Affairs. They have a beautiful website, and you can click on the county service officers, and then you put in the county that you want. I was just on there the other day, and actually the picture of the county service officer will come up. The phone numbers and everything is right there, right on the website that the MDVA has. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. And with that,
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Marquardt.
It also in the packet is our website. It's macvso.org. And like the chair said, you can see any one of our pictures unless they're new. We do have a few new service officers, but it'll have their contact phone number, their email, their fax on there, and you can give that out to your constituents because they need it just as much as you do, if not more.
And Chair Davids, Fillmore County must have it together, right?
And so does Houston County.
Okay. With that, we're adjourned.